Jamie slowly swung down from the saddle.
Is it over now, Jamie?
It is as far as I'm concerned. But Aaron Layfield got away with some of his men. I can't speak for him, Kate.
Tell us where he went, Pa. We'll ride over and clean out that nest of snakes once and for all.
Hush, Falcon. Let's talk of peace.
There ain't gonna be no peace until this fool Layfield is in the grave, Ma. We might as well get it done now.
Don't sass your mother, Morgan.
Jamie, where's Hannah?
Laid to rest the way she wanted, Kate. She and Sweet are together on the Starry Path.
Did she die well?
That she did. Audie said he had never met a braver woman.
Then all the ones who came west with us are gone.
I suppose so. Let me rest and bathe and eat. Then I'll tell you all what happened.
Jamie felt sure that Layfield would strike again, for the man was a fanatic, the most unpredictable of types. But as the summer wore on, Jamie began to relax and enjoy the season. Friends had spotted Layfield and reported the location to him, telling Jamie that Layfield seemed to be waiting for something.
Supplies, probably. The Army has assured me that Layfield no longer has any government connections. A federal judge threw out those fake warrants against me as well.
Then he'll strike here, you think?
I'm sure that's what he plans to do. But I won't give him that chance. I have people watching his movements. When he starts to move, I'll be notified. Then I'll put an end to this nonsense once and for all.
But this time you'll take the boys, and a few of the other men with you.
If you say so, dear.
I definitely say so.
But Layfield made no moves other than to go into a mining town half a day's ride from his camp for supplies. As the summer began drawing to a close, Jamie finally put two and two together. Somehow, Layfield had learned that Andrew and Rosanna and their troupe of dancers, singers, musicians, and actors were going to play Denver and then come spend a week or so in McAllister's Valley before heading on to San Francisco. Layfield was waiting until they arrived before striking. This was a bad time to take men away from the fields, for the growing season was short and harvest was critical. Jamie saddled up and rode around his Twin Valleys, or as much of it as he could in a full day. The valleys were filled with people, farmers, small ranchers. More than 600 people at last count now lived in the Twin Valleys. They had a government, a sheriff, law and order, schools, churches, and a fine little town. Jamie sat his horse on a ridge and looked down on both valleys and was filled with pride. He had first seen these valleys nearly 35 years back. He recalled digging and letting Swede smell the good, rich earth. The Swede had smiled and fingered the dirt. Now Swede was gone, as was Hannah. Sam and Sarah were gone, Juan and Maria, Moses and Liza, and Titus and Reverend Haywood and Lydia. All gone, dead and buried. Jamie dismounted to squat on the ground, gazing out over the valleys. He chewed on a blade of grass and fell deep in thought as he looked out over the land.
Those of us who came first have deep roots here. We will leave behind kids and grandkids and great-grandkids to carry on. I cannot let a madman destroy all that we have worked so hard to build.
Jamie stepped into the saddle and rode back. Kate was sitting on the front porch when Jamie returned.
I'm thinking I'm going hunting. Winter will be here before we know it, and we need to stock up and jerk some meat.
How are you getting senile, old man? We have herds of cattle and flocks of sheep and hundreds of chickens. Those hard time years are behind us, Jamie. Tell me the real reason you want to ride off.
I just need to get away for a time. I want to ride to the High Lonesome before the kids get here.
Then say so, Jamie Ian McAllister. Don't you story to me.
Yes, ma'am.
Andrew and Rosanna and their performers were coming to Denver for a week of shows. Always the performer himself, Ross couldn't resist the pull of a musical troupe. He decided that he would send a messenger to reserve a box seat at the Opera House. Then, as always, Ross's thoughts wandered to his sister. He wondered where she had chosen to hide. He'd be willing to wager that she was somewhere here in the West, and if he had to take a guess, he would bet it was San Francisco. He made up his mind. He would hire detectives to find her, and then arrange to have her killed. Anne LeBeau, now known as Andrea Petri, read the article about Andrew and Rosanna coming to San Francisco with great interest. She had quietly followed the twins' careers for years, and she was anxious to see him perform. She rang for one of her servants and sent him over to the music hall to reserve a box seat for one of the performances. Anne often wondered where her brother had chosen to hide and what he was doing. He was here in the West somewhere, she was certain of that. But while the West was vast, the cities were few. She'd be willing to bet it was Denver. Anne made up her mind. She would hire detectives to find Ross, and then she'd have him killed.
Where's Pa going, Ma?
Wander the high country for a week or so. Or so he says.
Morgan went home to pack. Within 10 minutes, Jamie Ian walked over to his brother Matthew's house.
Pa just rode out, and he was leading the pack horse. Morgan was right behind him. Something sure up.
I'll get saddled. You get together some supplies and lots of ammo.
Falcon walked over to little Ben Pardee's house.
You seen Pa or any of my brothers, Ben?
Seen Matt and Jamie Ian ride out a few minutes ago, leading a pack horse. What's up?
I think Pa's gone off to fight that goddamn Layfield.
Damn it! I'll saddle up.
I'll get the supplies.
Jamie topped a ridge and swung down from the saddle, letting his horses blow and then water and graze for a time. He looked behind him. He knew by the way the rider sat his horse that it was Morgan about a mile back. That dust a couple of miles behind Morgan was surely more of his sons coming up. Jamie built a small fire and put on water for coffee.
Damn. Well, might as well wait until they catch up. I taught them all. I won't be able to shake them.
Morgan rode up and stepped out of the saddle. He walked over to the fire and squatted down.
Gone for a little ride, huh, Pa?
That was my plan. Alone, too.
Ma suggested I sort of tag along with you. Man of your advanced age, you know.
She said that, did she?
There's so many words.
Oh, I just bet she did. You ought to not lie to your Pa, boy.
Me tell a lie to you? No, me, Pa. Oh, by the way, that's Jamie Ian and Matt coming up behind me.
Wonderful.
And them two behind them is surely Falcon and Little Ben.
Now, that's just dandy.
I think it's kind of nice for a father and his sons to get together for a hunting trip every now and then.
Sure it is. No telling what kind of game we might bag this trip out. You make up your mind to give up scouting for the Army permanently, boy?
I thought of mine. Me being married and all. I bought that piece of land the Simmons gave up.
That's real nice, boy. Your ma will be pleased.
Besides, somebody's got to hang around to look after you in your advanced age.
Oh, shit.
After a couple of seconds, Jamie ducked his head to hide his smile and dumped the coffee in the boiling water, then added a bit of cold water to settle the grounds.
You gonna kill this nut Layfield, Pa?
I'm gonna try to talk to him first, boy, if he'll let me. I want to tell him the war's over and done with. And I'll leave me and mine be.
And if he don't care to listen, and I'll bet you 5 horses to 1 he won't.
He better listen. I think I'm being right charitable toward him. He and his men killed Hannah, Night Stalker, and Dark Hand. Wounded me and Audie. Speaking just for me, I'm willing to let it pass. But if he don't want to do that, then we can let the killing begin. What you thinking, boy?
A lot of things, Pa. Why does this Layfield hate you so? Why you particular?
I don't know, son, but he sure singled me out. Of course, years before, I did burn down his damn town.
Well, burning down a town might tend to piss some people off, Pa.
It was a war, son. But with Layfield, it's something deeper than that. I think the man is crazy. I just happened to come along at the right time when he was looking for something or someone to hate.
Jamie Ian and Matthew rode up and dismounted. Matthew got a cup from his saddlebags and moved to the fire, pouring a cup.
We thought we'd just tag along with you, Pa.
Yeah, Pa. You might get lost in the woods or something.
Who's that there behind you?
I don't rightly know, Pa.
Try Falcon and Ben Pardee. See how that fits your mouth.
Well, now, it just might be them.
Uh-huh.
Pa?
What?
How come you hitting Layfield and his bunch now after all this time?
Andrew and Rosanna.
I see.
Layfield's been waiting till we all gather in the valley. He wants to be sure he gets all the McAllisters.
That's my thinking on it, boy. And James William and his new bride will be there, too. Even though Layfield's only got about 30 or so men, he could do a lot of damage. Because I don't think the man cares whether he lives or dies, just as long as he gets me. That's why I wanted to go this alone.
Pa, just as long as there are two McAllisters or kin alive, the other ain't never going to be alone.
Falcon and Ben Pardee rode into the camp.
All right, light and sit, boys. Let's plan this out, since it's going to be a family affair.
Rosanna and Andrew and Troop had arrived in the boomtown of Denver and were staying at the finest hotel in the city. They were all anxious to get the shows over with and head for McAllister's Valley. It had been years since they'd seen their parents. They had lots to talk about and new babies to see and lots of Kate's good home-cooked meals to eat. She had written them both, and Ellen Kathleen had written James. Everybody was looking forward to a big eating on the grounds and to some fine entertainment from world-renowned professionals. And Jamie and Sons and little Ben Pardee, among others that Jamie was not yet aware of, aimed to see that everybody got their wishes. Everybody, that is, except Colonel Aaron Layfield.
There's a whole passel of folks paralleling us, Pa, but I couldn't get close enough to see just who they might be. They're staying to the flats as much as possible.
How many folks?
About 50, I think.
The army?
No, and I'm sure of that. And I'm also sure they're not outlaws either.
How can you be sure of that?
I went into one of their campsites. It was all cleaned and tidied up. Stone fire rings was laid, and the fires carefully put out. They even dug latrines, Pa, and filled them in when they was done.
You're right, that was no outlaw camp.
What do we do, Pa?
Nothing. Layfield's camp is a day and a half away, and I want this issue settled once and for all. I don't know what those other men are doing out here, but they're staying a distance away and leaving us alone. We'll do the same for them. Let's go.
Jamie McAllister and a few others are coming, Colonel Layfield.
Good, good. Have the men get into position.
They're coming under a white flag, sir.
Very well. I shall honor a white flag of truce. Let them enter the camp.
Layfield went to his tent, carefully dressed in his best uniform, and laid out his plumed hat. He pulled on his freshly blacked boots and buckled on his sword. He brushed his hair and combed his beard and stepped out of his tent. He walked to the edge of the camp, and waited for Jamie Ian McAllister.
At last. I've got him at last, and he is coming to me.
Jamie and Sons and Ben Pardee rode to the edge of the camp, Jamie in the lead. They stopped about 50 feet from Layfield.
Don't he look nice now?
Oh, elegant.
Colonel Layfield?
Colonel McAllister?
I've come to talk peace. The war is over.
Not our war, sir. Not until one of us is dead and in the grave will it be over.
Why? Why does it have to be that way?
Because we are enemies.
Colonel, the war is done with. Your side won. Lee surrendered. I have no reason to fight you, and you have no reason to fight me.
Are you forgetting that you destroyed my town, Colonel McAllister?
Are you forgetting that you destroyed several dozen towns in the south, Colonel Layfield?
That was different. Oh, my, yes, sir. Much different.
Different, sir? How? Why?
You were the enemy, sir, that's why. And because you were the enemy, you are the enemy. That's in the Bible. That was quite a fight you put up in that old town, Colonel. Yes, indeed, quite a fight. But there was something missing there.
Oh, what?
The rebel flag, of course.
It's been over almost 5 years. Hostilities have ceased. Would you like for me to apologize for burning down your town, sir?
Don't be ridiculous, sir. That was war. One never apologizes for acts committed during war. I think we have said all there is to say to each other, Colonel McAllister. You should withdraw now and prepare for battle.
Not in a pecan pie. Man needs to be put in an insane asylum.
What's that? What did you say, sir?
I said you're nuts. You're holding the reins too tight.
You can't speak to me in such a manner.
I just did, you nitwit.
Prepare for battle, sir!
Thanks a lot, brother. Your mouth has done it again.
My God! Look up at the ridgelines!
Cease and desist, Layfield!
Jamie looked up. Troops of the U.S. Army Cavalry lined one side. He cut his eyes to the other side, where about 50 men from his own valley stood, all armed with rifles.
You are under arrest, Colonel Layfield. I am Major Paul Silver, United States Army. Order your men to lay down their weapons and do so immediately.
Never! I have God on my side! I shall never surrender! Death to all traitors!
Boys, get ready to leave the saddle. Get behind those rocks yonder and keep your heads down. It's about to get real wild here.
Fire, men!
Now!
Fire!
It was a slaughter. When the firing stopped, Layfield was still standing, turning around and around, waving his sword. Jamie stood up and walked to the man, grabbing his arm and taking the sword from him.
No!
Morgan tied the man's hands behind him and sat him on the ground.
I am a colonel. I will not be treated in such a manner.
Hush up. You're gonna have a nice long rest, Layfield. You need it.
Strike this infidel dead, Lord! Fling a lightning bolt from the heavens with your mighty hand and destroy this heathen!
This guy is nuttier than a tree full of squirrels, Colonel.
The men from the valley and the cavalrymen rode up.
Colonel McAllister, I'm Major Silver. We tried to get here in time to arrest these men peacefully, but we were delayed.
You got here just in time, Major.
Jamie looked at the men from the valley.
What can I say, man?
You don't have to say anything, Mr. McAllister. We were only too glad to help.
I'll have President Lincoln court-martial you for high treason against the United States government and hang you all!
I think somebody needs to tell him that Lincoln's dead.
Oh, yeah? Be my guest.
Charge! Slay the infidels! Kill the slavers! Blow, bugler, blow!
What will you do with him, Major Silver?
I'm sure he'll be confined to a lunatic asylum, if he doesn't have a heart attack before we get him there. Excuse me for a moment, sir. Sergeant Bolren, get the surgeon up here and dose this man with laudanum. Keep him quieted down for his own safety.
Let's go home, sir. We have much to do before the performers arrive.
Let's do that, Reverend Powell.
But I still think the Indian way makes more sense.
I'll convert you yet, Jamie and McAllister. You just wait and see.
Glory, glory, hallelujah! His soul goes marching on.
As Ross LeBeau sat in his expensive box seat and watched the performers on the stage, he was filled with a strange sort of sadness. It was like nothing he had ever experienced before. He remembered Andrew and Rosanna McAllister with a smile. He would have recognized them anywhere. And he was forced to admit they were superb performers, much more talented than he had expected them to be. He thought of his own children, Garrison and Chastity, the boy and the girl he would never see again. That, he realized with a start, was the reason for his sudden sadness. Paternal instincts rearing up quite unexpectedly. He missed the boy and the girl. That was the simple truth Ross was forced to admit. They were part of him, and that cannot be denied. He had detectives working to find his sister's whereabouts. That was going to take some time, months probably. A bitter smile creased his lips as he reflected on the past. A house of cards, Anne had called their lives. Well, Ross thought with a sigh, that was a very apt description. A house of cards. Roscoe Jefferson, who had changed his name to Ross LeBeau and who now lived under the name of Russell Clay, sat alone in his box in the theater and silently wept. Hundreds of miles to the west, Andrea Petri sat in her grand home, surrounded by expensive and lovely possessions, and was alone with her thoughts. Her ruminations, however, were not nearly so gentle as her brother's. She did love her daughter Paige in her own strange way, and for a time she had felt some affection for Ben Franklin Washington. But no more. the boy had very nearly ruined things for, and Anne was not the type of person to forgive and forget. Now she had learned that Ben Franklin Washington was continuing his snooping around Richmond.
You're a fool, Benjamin, and unless you back off, it's going to cost you most dearly. Your life. I missed once. I shall not miss the next time.
The authorities had ruled that Anne Woodville had died in the tragic fire that had consumed Ravenswood Plantation. It was plain for all to see that the two men tried to rob Mrs. Woodville, and she, although mortally wounded, had managed to shoot them both. During the struggle, lamps had been overturned and the great house set on fire. Ben Franklin Washington didn't believe a word of it, and he was more determined than ever to learn the facts. One way or the other, he would start digging up bones and uncover the truth, and he no longer gave a damn whose apple cart got upset. Jamie rode back with the men from his valley. For the first time in years, he was at peace with himself and the world, and it was a very strange feeling. So far as he knew, he had not a single enemy left in the world, at least not that he could think of. He had some good years left in him, a few more anyway. Now he and Kate could grow old together, side by side, and peacefully. As he rode, with the company of good and loyal friends all around him, Jamie again thought that he had everything any man could ever hope for. He and Kate had their health, 9 kids who were all as fertile as any bottom land in the country, more grandkids and great-grandkids than he could count, an ample time to take it easy and enjoy life. Falcon had put off his marriage to Marie until the trouble was all over and his brother and sister came to the valley. Now that was set for next month. Falcon was a good boy, but he could be as wild as the wind. Marie, though, both Jamie and Kate hoped would settle him down. Falcon would be the last of their kids to marry, the last eagle to leave the nest. The wedding was a sight to behold. Kate cared for Falcon and Marie's twins during the ceremony. Everybody in the Twin Valleys oohed and aahed and carried on over the black-haired, pale-eyed twin brother and sister. Andrew's wife and Rosanna's husbands both arched an eyebrow and looked a little cockeyed at that, but they said nothing. It was, after all, the Wild West of America, where people did things differently, much differently. Marie's immediate family, including aunts and uncles and cousins, were in attendance in full Cheyenne regalia. Almost too quickly, the wedding was over, and the bride and groom disappeared into their house. Jamie and Kate were keeping the twins until the honeymoon was over. Everybody'd gone home, and Reverend Powell was quite pleased that Marie and Falcon had been officially married in the eyes of God, even more pleased that Jamie had actually set foot in his church. The troop members were staying in various homes, and Jamie and Kate were alone on their front porch with the twins playing and cooing and gurgling in their crib.
Are those two kids really number 42 and 43?
Yes. Oh, we certainly come a long way, haven't we, Jamie?
Yeah. Two scared kids running west. Your pa disowning you, and me with a murder warrant on my head. My God, Kate, that was 45 years ago. That's just damn hard for me to believe.
Seems like yesterday. Jamie, do you feel old?
Not really. I like to go to bed a bit earlier than I used to, linger longer under the blankets come the morning. I enjoy sunsets and the rising up more than I did when I was younger, but old? No.
Jamie, Ian and Ellen Kathleen are both 44 years old. Our youngest is 31.
Woman, how in the hell can you keep all those dates and names in your head? It boggles my mind just thinking about it.
Kate's grandson chose that time to spit up all over himself. Kate rose to clean him up. She plopped the girl in Jamie's lap and took the boy into the house. The child promptly snuggled up in her grandfather's arms and went to sleep.
My little breed. You've got a hell of a background, girl. Scotch, French, German, Cheyenne, and God only knows what else. I won't live to see you finally pick a man and settle down. But you're going to be a heartbreaker, I can tell that right off. And a wildcat, you got that blood in you. You're going to see things happen in your lifetime that your grandma and me couldn't even dream of. This whole world is changing fast, and you're going to be part of it. I envy you that.
Jamie's eyes caught a flash of sunlight off metal high up in the hills. It came and went in a bright, sudden wink, but it was there. He studied the hills for a time, but the flash didn't come again.
Travelers, I guess. Place is sure filling up, girl. When your grandma and me came out here, there wasn't nobody but us and your folks and the like. Now there's wagons rumbling through nearabouts every day, seems like. Civilization is upon us. I reckon that's good. Couldn't have stopped it if I wanted to.
The day was warm, and Jamie fell asleep on the front porch, holding the child in his arms. Kate stepped out a few minutes later, saw the sleeping pair, gently took the girl without waking her husband. She went into the house and placed the child on a pallet on the floor beside her now cleaned up and sleeping brother. Kate stepped back outside just as Jamie was opening his eyes and looking all around him.
Hey, where's...
I took her in. She's asleep on a pallet with her brother. Jamie, there's riders coming.
There were five riders, and they wore long dusters, a garb that was growing ever popular among travelers. There was nothing about the riders to arouse suspicion, so Jamie paid them no mind. He stood up and went around the house to the well to draw a bucket of cold water. He sloughed his head with the cold water, and that woke him up. Then he suddenly recalled that five other riders had ridden in the day before and taken rooms at the hotel, and they too had been wearing dusters. Louis Husky, who owned the new hotel, had said the men were polite and well-behaved, didn't drink too much, and they caused no trouble. Jamie started doing some repairs around the house that he'd been putting off all summer. He lost himself in the work and didn't notice the five other men who rode slowly into town, or those who followed about a half hour later. The last bunch didn't ride into town. They camped about 2 miles outside the settlement in a thick stand of timber along a creek. The land on either side had not been used for farming that year because of flooding, and it was a perfect place for a small group of men to hide out. Jamie woke up suddenly in the middle of the night, remembering that the next day was the day of the month the stage line always sent an extra stage, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, to bring in cash and carry out gold from the new mines. But he drifted back off to sleep, wondering why he should be thinking about that. The stages were always heavily guarded, and he'd heard that this line was under contract to Wells Fargo or some big outfit, and nobody in their right mind messed around with companies like that. Their detectives would spend a lifetime hunting men down. When he awakened the next morning, Jamie had forgotten all about the riders. Meg came over just after breakfast and took the twins back to her house for the day, Jamie carrying Falcon Jr. for her. After dropping the twins off, Jamie walked into town and stopped in at the hotel for a cup of coffee with Dr. Tom Prentice and Louis Husky. Out of long habit, Jamie had tucked a pistol behind his wide leather belt.
About time for the stage to arrive.
Whose horses are those at the hitch rail, Louis? I don't recognize the brand.
Beats me, Colonel. They was tied up there when I opened up this morning. But they haven't been there long. No droppings around them.
I seen Matthew riding out before dawn. I waved at him, and he said there'd been some trouble up to one of the mining camps. Said he ought to be back around noon.
You're quiet this morning, Jamie. You feel all right?
Fit as a fiddle, Tom. I just have an odd sort of feeling, that's all.
Kate all right?
Ornery as ever.
The man who ran the bank, Paul Carrington, strolled in and joined the men at the table, ordering breakfast. Jamie noticed that the man looked worried.
Everything all right, Paul? You look a little more worried than usual.
Hell of a double shipment coming in today, Jamie. More than twice the usual amount of cash, and we've changed schedules. We're shipping out on the return run.
You have plenty of guards, don't you?
Well, I damn sure hope so. I'm sitting on a fortune of gold at the bank. It's got me jumpy. Matthew rode out to one end of the county this morning to check on trouble, and the two deputies rode out to the other end. That leaves us with no lawmen.
There's more to it than that, Paul. Come on, what's the matter?
The Nelson gang. Miles Nelson escaped from the territorial prison and was spotted heading this way. His old gang ran anywhere from 20 to 50 men, and no bigger band of cutthroats exists anywhere.
Surely they wouldn't attack a Wells Fargo stage or bank.
They'd attack anything. Way I heard it, Miles Nelson is connected to some big money back east. Has political connections, too. He and some of his men are blood-related to a group of powerful men back east named Newby and Saxon.
What'd you say, Louie?
I said Newby and Saxon.
Do they mean something to you, Jamie?
Maybe. Saxons and the Newbies are old enemies of mine and Kate's. A blood feud that goes back more than 40 years. You armed, Louie?
I ain't carrying one on me. Hell, Jamie, you're about the only person in town who packs a gun, other than Falcon and Matthew and his deputies. There's never any trouble here. This is the safest spot in all of Colorado.
It might not be today. Get a pistol, all of you.
Jamie, no one in their right mind would attack this town, would they?
Miles Nelson might, and he might be doing it for more than one reason.
Damn!
Look out the window! Here comes the stage! No, there's two of them.
Jamie rose and walked to the windows of the dining room. He watched as eight men got off the two stages, all of them wearing dusters and all of them carrying rifles.
God damn it! Dusters! Dusters! I should have put it together. I must be getting old.
That's odd. Must be nigh on to 30 men done come into town. All wearing those fancy dusters.
The Nelson gang wears dusters! That's the Nelson gang out there!
The banker pushed open the door and stepped out, frantically looking up and down the street. Women were beginning to appear on the boardwalks, ready to do the day's shopping. The school bell was ringing. School would commence in 15 minutes. Boys and girls were all over the place, all of them slowly walking toward the schoolhouse.
Oh, God. This could turn into a slaughter.
Then it came to Jamie. Miles Nelson had planned it this way. Townspeople would be reluctant to shoot for fear of hitting women and kids. Jamie turned, walked back into the restaurant, and jerked the pistol from the waistband of a very startled traveler who had just sat down to eat.
Gina!
Shut up! Everybody get down! All hell is about to break open here.
The diners left their chairs and stretched out on the floor. Jamie headed out the door. Paul Carrington was hurrying across the street when one of the duster-wearing men coldly pulled out a pistol and shot the driver of the stage out of the box. The outlaw leaped onto the stage and grabbed up the reins. Paul turned and took a bullet right between his eyes. Jamie shot the outlaw out of the driver's box. The team panicked, running up the street, wild-eyed and frightened.
It worked, boys! There's McAllister! Kill him!
Setup. The words flashed through Jamie's mind. The whole thing was a setup to get him, or at least part of it was.
These outlaws coming from both ends of it.
Kate! Oh, Jesus, Kate!
Jamie shot through the hotel restaurant, ran out the back door and headed for his house, ducking behind houses and into alleys. A duster-clad man, both hands filled with pistols, stepped out in front of him.
You're a dead man,
Another duster-wearing man came galloping up the street in front of Jamie's house, firing at the frightened and running women and kids in his path. Jamie shot him out of the saddle. Kate stepped out of their home, a Henry rifle in her hands.
Kate!
She immediately slumped bonelessly to the porch. Jamie ran across the street just as a heavy explosion shook the earth. Someone had blown the safe at the bank, but Jamie's thoughts were not of money or of gold. He jumped up onto the porch just as his sons and son-in-laws threw up a circle around the house and drove off any of the Nelson gang who might have had the stupidity to remain within range of the McAllister boys' deadly fire. Jamie knelt down beside Kate. His tears were falling onto Kate's dress, thick and sticky with blood, where the heavy slug had passed clear through her slender body between her breasts.
Jamie, I'll be waiting for you on the starry path. Don't say anything, Jamie. I know. I can't feel anything from the waist down. I'm not in pain, love. I'm in peace. Jamie, I see baby Karen. I see her.
Dr. Tom Prentice was running up the street, ducking and dodging the flying lead from the outlaw guns, making his way to the McAllister home, carrying his black bag. He leaped the white-painted picket fence that Jamie had just prepared, ran into the yard, and jumped up onto the porch. Tom Prentice took one look at Kate and stepped back, leaving the man and wife alone on the porch, knowing there was nothing he could do. The fire from the McAllister's guns had driven the Nelson gang far away from that end of the street. No one among the outlaws wanted to face those angry guns. Jamie leaned down and kissed Kate's bloody lips.
Jamie, don't fret. We'll be together again. You be good, darling. Take care of yourself. I'll be waiting.
Jamie put his arms around her and held her close, but Kate said no more. Jamie held Kate for a long time. No one tried to interfere. No one said a word. Finally, Jamie gently lowered Kate to the porch floor and stood up. His crying was done. He was dry-eyed. He felt a coldness about him.
Ellen, Kathleen, take care of your ma. Help your sister, Jamie Ann.
Jamie stepped into the house and buckled on his twin Colts. He reached up to the pegboard and took down his scalping knife. Walked back out onto the porch.
What are you going to do, Jamie?
Find out where the gang went, Reverend.
How?
You ever seen a man skinned alive, Reverend?
Good Lord, no.
Then you better plug up your ears.
Jamie stepped off the porch and started walking toward town.
He doesn't mean that.
You want a bet?
Falcon pushed past the man and went to his mother's side. Jamie dragged one slightly wounded outlaw off the street and into a blacksmith shop and closed the big double door.
You go to hell, McAllister! I ain't telling you nothing! No! Ah!
A few minutes later, Jamie stepped out of the smithies and walked back to his house. There was a bloody scalp hanging from his belt.
Pa, I'll fetch the dress that Ma bought in San Francisco.
No. Your Ma always said she wasn't cut out to be silk and lace. She said she wanted to be buried in gingham. Pick out a simple dress. Jamie Ian, you get a couple of picks and shovels and meet me up yonder where Grandpa's buried. That's where your Ma and me plan to be planted. And go on now.
Pa, did that outlaw tell you anything?
He told me plenty.
Are we gonna ride?
Not we, boy. Just me. And don't give me no shit about it.
Kate was buried late that afternoon, just as the sun was beginning to sink in the west and the shadows were long. Reverend Powell kept it short, as Jamie had requested. After the service, Jamie told everybody to go on back home. He was going to stay by the grave for a time. Jamie built a small fire and put on water for coffee. He'd fixed him a poke of food from the house before leaving to dig the grave.
I'll have a proper headstone up before I take off, Kate. I promise you that. Then I'm going to find those that plotted and carried out this thing. I know that don't come as no surprise to you, Kate. Some of the kids will be up here most every day after I pull out, putting flowers and such on your grave. Then it'll taper off to once a week, and once a month, and then once a year. That's just the way it is, Kate. They gotta live their own lives. I'm gonna make you a promise, Kate. And I'll do my damnest to keep it. I will be laid to rest beside you. Kids will know that before I pull out. And some of them will come get me no matter where I fall or where I'm planted. Kate, we had just over 45 years together. And to my mind, they were good ones. I loved you the first moment I put eyes on you. And I love you now. There's never been another woman for me, and there never will be. I think you've always known that, but I just wanted to remind you one more time. Kate, I'm not right enough to get myself killed. You know me better than that. But it ain't going to be right without you here, honey. I'm feeling sort of lost right now. I guess you know that, listening to me rambling on like an idiot here. There are just things I have to say, and I gotta say them now.
Jamie leaned back against a mound of earth that covered Kate. He took comfort in being just that close to her, and he was silent for a long time, drawing strength from her nearness.
Well, old woman, I thought I had a lot to say, but I reckon I've just said it all. I'll sleep now, beside you for the last time on this earth. And then tomorrow, I'll see to your stone, and then I'll be gone. Good night, Kate. You sleep in peace. I love you.
The next day, Jamie chiseled these words into a huge stone. Kate McAllister, born 1810, died 1869. Beloved wife of Jamie Ian McAllister, born 1810, died. He left that blank. Matthew, Falcon, Morgan, Jamie Ian, and Andrew were sitting on the front porch of the house when Jamie got back. Someone had cleaned up Kate's blood, or they'd tried to. Jamie could still see a spot where Kate had lain.
I gotta talk to you, Pa.
So talk, Matt.
Pa, we got laws in this country now.
Is that a fact?
Damn it, Pa, don't make light of that. This territory is soon gonna be a state, but we got to show the folks back east that we're civilized enough for that to happen.
Your ma lies yonder on that ridge, boy, cold in her grave. And you're gonna talk to me about laws? Don't waste your breath, boy, and my time.
Pa, every sheriff in the territory has been notified about what happened yesterday. It'll be coast to coast in a few weeks, maybe less time than that. The Nelson gang will be found, Pa, I guarantee it.
I guarantee you they will be found too, boy, by me.
Pa, you're 60 years old. You're not a kid. You're a grown man with lots of sense. Pa, I'll stop you from doing this if I have to.
Jamie knocked Matthew off the porch into the front yard, unconscious. Falcon, Morgan, Jamie, Ian, and Andrew sat on the porch and watched Matthew hit the ground. Jamie went in the house.
Sounded like Pa hit him with the flat side of an axe, don't it?
Pa slapped me open-handed one time. I was about 16, I reckon. My head rung for 2 days, and I couldn't hear out my left side for a week. I never bowed up to Pa again after that.
Pa's killed man with his fists.
You reckon we ought to throw some water on our brother?
No, he was up all night. He needs a rest.
Oh, damn. What the hell did Pa hit me with? A tree?
No, his fist. You're just lucky you got a hard head.
Oh, I got me some loose teeth.
They'll tighten up. Just eat soup for a few days.
Don't you ever bow up to me again, boy. You understand me?
Yes, sir.
Now, you boys say goodbye to the family for me. You know I'm not much for long farewells, and I don't want to see no tears. Matt, go pack my blankets and other possibles. Jamie Ian, put together some food for me. You help him, Andrew. Morgan, go help Falcon. He's about half scared of that big buckskin.
The boys left to do as their father had asked. Jamie sat alone on the porch until the boys had saddled up and packed up the horses and led him around. Jamie shook hands with his sons and stepped into the saddle. He didn't look back as he rode off, right down the main street of the town that he and Kate and a few other adventurous pioneers had settled so many years back. Little Ben Pardee, Dr. Tom Prentice, and Louie Husky stood on the boardwalk in front of the hotel and saluted as Jamie rode by. He returned the salute and kept on riding, putting the town behind him. Jamie rode up to Kate's final resting place, dismounted, took off his hat, and stood by her grave. The kids had been up on the ridge because the mound was covered in flowers. There were signs that Indians had visited the grave, for their tokens of tribute and sorrow were there too.
Well, old woman, this is goodbye for a time. I reckon I just got this to say. All that down yonder would never have happened had it not been for you, Kate. That's your real monument down there. Folks living and loving, working and fussing, making up, and going on about their business and building a future for their kids and grandkids and the like. Yes, ma'am. I reckon that's what it's all about.
Talons of Eagles is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1996, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, David Coyne, Terrence Azelford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Sonny Lasky, Ken Jackson, Casey Jones, Karen Carbone, James Konacek, Dolores King-Williams, Christopher Graybill, Christopher Walker, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, and Chris Rowan. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Bob Supan. Vocal editing by Nathaniel Perry. Graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler and Nathaniel Perry. Additional original music by Christian Parent, Johann Detweiler, and Greg Reinfeld. Additional original music by Christian Parent, Johann Detweiler, and Greg Reinfeld. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Talons of Eagles, be sure to look for our other graphic audio titles, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com.
The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Destroyer number 100, Last Rites.
Remo stepped into the circle, feeling the cool, moist clay against the bare soles of his feet. The great sumo regarded him with a dour face. He bowed from the waist. The merest of bows. 10 degrees. Remo bowed equally in return.
I'll try to make this quick.
Suit yourself, Skinny.
You speak English?
It's a Sumi.
Huh?
It's my stage name. I'm as American as you, chopstick legs. Born on Oahu, raised on MTV, destined to stomp your gourd.
Says you.
With a speed that surprised even Remo, the giant lunged, sweeping his great flabby arms around in a bear hug. Remo ducked under the scissors of flesh and aimed 2 stiffened fingers for a nerve cluster under 1 sweaty armpit. The fingers sunk in up to the 2nd knuckle and came out again. Remo wove to one side so the falling sumo didn't land on him. Only the sumo didn't fall. He took Remo's shoulders in each hand. Remo felt himself lifted off his feet. And when he landed outside the ring, he rolled and snapped to his feet unharmed. He found himself facing his master.
Does that mean I lose?
I neglected to say 2 falls out of 3.
Good.
The sumo lifted 1 foot and slammed it down. The other came down a moment later. He assumed a crouching defensive posture.
Get set for a ride, shrimp.
Anytime you're ready, fat boy.
In the time of the early chrysanthemum throne, a shogun of Japan, jealous of the spreading fame of Shinanju and unable to secure the secrets of the house, sought to create an invincible army that would protect him from a rival shogun. These warriors were called sumo.
I never heard that.
History is written by the victorious.
Remo circled his foe warily. The sumo held his ground, as if daring Remo to strike first.
This shogun discovered that no weapon, no samurai or ninja, was proof against Shinanju.
A hand as broad as a seat cushion swatted at Remo. Remo evaded it easily. Still, the speed of the sumo was greater than he imagined possible.
The shogun knew that there was no speed equal to Shinanju, no blow faster, no skill greater. So he consulted his advisors for a defense against Shinanju.
Remo fainted for the blubbery, rolling stomach and came around with an open-handed spank to the kidney.
He discovered an armor that was proof against the blows and strikes of Shinanju. This was called fat.
Remo tried for the solar plexus. He stepped in, using the hard heels of his hands, machine-gunning the rolls of fat that lay there.
Fat, the shogun discovered, was proof against the blows that could otherwise paralyze nerves and break bones.
The sumo's stomach muscles rolled like pink waves. A red mark, like a rash, bloomed where Remo had struck, but otherwise no harm had been done.
For fat, gave before the hand of Shinanju, accepting and resisting like water.
I can see that, damn it!
Big surprise, huh, Skinny? You thought a big guy like me would be a pushover for your slick kung fu moves. Not so easy, huh? Yokozuna. That means grand champion. I'm the first American to pull it off.
The shogun surrounded himself with giant men who shook the earth with their tread. Word was sent out to the countryside. Chun of those days was challenged to assassinate the shogun if he dared.
Remo eyed the ankles like fleshy tree stumps.
What do the rules say about tripping?
Tripping is forbidden.
You gotta grab me about the waist and try to muscle me out of the ring. Too bad you don't have the wingspan for it.
Master Yowin came to Japan to meet this challenge. By night, he stole into the sleeping chamber of the shogun, but a wall of living flesh blocked him. Blows were struck and landed forcefully, but the sumo wall stood resolute.
Stepping back, Remo coiled his muscles tight. He sprang. Both hands slammed into the sumo's great chest. Susumi staggered back, staggered one step, then two, but 5 feet from the periphery of the ring of clay, he recovered and flung his bulk forward like a cannonball with pumping legs. Remo backpedaled, staying one tantalizing step ahead of the sumo. When he felt the bite of gravel under his right heel, he leaped high over the sumo's head, pivoted, and gave the sweaty pink back a hard push. Susumi leaned like a sequoia in a hurricane, his upper body tipped out of the ring, but his feet stood firm like immobile roots. Body nearly perpendicular to his legs, he fought the natural tendency of his great bulk to topple. Remo watched in helpless frustration as he slowly righted himself and turned to face him again.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.